science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
All right, Alan. 15 minutes.
15 minutes. You'd be lucky.
Let's go. Babies, yeah. What do babies like to hear in the womb?
This is interesting. Who funds this sort of study? That's what gets me. So this is a place called the Institut Marquès in Barcelona.
Yes, Barcelona. Indeed. They're great.
And so this is a sort of an institute of gynecology, et cetera, et cetera. And they decided that they would figure out what music most stimulated babies in the womb. And so I can see a question coming already.
I mean, what's wrong with funding this research?
Is
stimulation good for the baby?
Well, we don't know, do we? So all that they're going on is sort of signs of mouth movement and tongue movement, apparently, because that indicates a stimulated baby in the womb. So we're assuming that stimulation is good, and they're not sort of, you know, crying, like, get me out of here or something like that when they're hearing this music.
Shouldn't there be research on that? Whether there's
that's probably the follow-up. So anyway, they got how many babies? 300 babies. That's quite a lot of babies, between 18 and 38 weeks. And so that's what they were looking for. They were looking for movement of the mouth and poking out of the tongue in response to hearing particular pieces of music. So the music ranged across the musical spectrum, all the way from classical through to traditional or world music, if you will, through to pop and rock, and also voices, the two voices being Mickey Mouse voices and human voices. And apparently the baby preferred Mickey Mouse voices. But
Mickey
of course,
Mouse
Mickey Mouse
baby.
Voice is actually a human voice, isn't it?
Yeah.
So ultimately, so not quite sure how that one went. Anyway, all of your listeners, I'm sure, are listening in big anticipation as to what was the best. It was Mozart, A Little Light Music.
Mozart.
Yeah.
Didn't we already know that? That's like good to. Really.
Yeah, A Little Light Music. So. That was the best amongst the classical ones. So there was lots of mouth movement and tongue movement and everything with Mozart. Bohemian Rhapsody, in fact, was up there as well. I'd say those babies had pretty good taste, actually.
Yeah.
And it was incorrectly reported that Beethoven's Ode to Joy was top. But no, I had a look at the actual paper itself, and no, that's down the bottom of the classical ones, in fact.
Why did they report it wrong?
And the worst song of all for stimulating your baby in the womb is Waka Waka by Shakira.
Oh, my God.
That, you're saying worse as in they just didn't move at all?
Yeah, they were not getting
not
down
into
or
it.
Whatever they were doing. Aww. But so, yeah, that was well and truly bottom. Closely followed by the Bee Gees' Too Much Heat. Heaven. And Adele's Someone Like You. Now, God, how they chose all of this stuff, really. If these are meant to be sort of representative pop songs, then
that was going
to
be my next question. How did they decide?
Yeah, well, so there you have it. So you've got to go for the classical if you want to stimulate your baby in the womb.
Okay, if you want to.
Now, of course, the really interesting thing about this is that apparently sort of babies can't really hear much in the womb if you just sort of bend down and sort of talk to a pregnant belly. They're not going to hear much.
You're breaking a myth.
I see where we're going.
And so in order for the babies to hear this, they had to use, quote, a specially designed vaginal speaker.
That's how you get closer.
Yeah.
So they put a speaker inside
indeed.
A vagina?
Yes, indeed they did.
It's pretty committed. Stimulating your baby.
Wow. Did they get some money for partaking in this research? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's always money for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd imagine there probably is. I don't know. But again, you know, my question remains, how do people get to do this sort of work? Who funds it? And, you know, it's a nice little sort of novelty puff science piece, but...
Well, I hope they eventually find something important. I mean, I think it's important to make noises and communicate to your baby. Isn't that what we've always been told?
Yeah, that's
really
what,
important.
That's what you've always been told. True, but you know that.
So
might...
should we not be speaking to the belly? We should be lying down and hanging out closer to the pelvic area. That's all right.
Yeah.
If you're a contortionist, yes.
Right. Okay.
So yeah.
Mozart.
Very interesting. So there you go, Mozart, that's the one. But again, very, very limited, only 15 pieces of music plus two voices. So, you know, as is usual with these things, further research is required.
Yeah, it is limited. And also, what are the limit? There must be other limitations, surely. Like, if the mother or the person carrying that baby
doesn't like it,
well, surely that would
You would imagine it would. So that, again, I bet that's going to be sort of an upcoming
then
study.
Next.
You know,
all right.
This is the way of getting 10 papers out of one piece of research. You know?
We'll follow this one.
With interest, yes.
Flat earthers. Talking about an experiment that's over 2,000 years old.
Yeah, and this is fascinating because tomorrow, I believe, is the 21st. Is that right?
June.
So that's the shortest day, or our winter solstice. But in the northern hemisphere, it's the summer solstice. Mm-hmm. And apparently, 2,000 and a bit years ago, the summer solstice came 2 days earlier due to sort of, I guess, irregularities in orbits and stuff like that. But on the 19th of June, 240 BC, a Greek fellow by the name of Eratosthenes figured out...
Just checking out the name.
Eratosthenes. He basically figured out the circumference of the Earth by doing a really quite brilliantly simple experiment that is 2,000 years old and proved that the Earth was round and not flat.
How did he do that?
Well, again, it's one of those things that you think, shit, I wish I'd thought of that. But so he knew that at Aswan in Egypt, where the high dam is now, he knew that on the summer solstice that the sun was directly overhead at noon on that day. The reason being that the sun is the furthest north that it can be, and that's the whole thing about the summer solstice. That's where the sun is at its furthest north point.
Yep.
Directly overhead Aswan. So at noon, when it's shining down on Aswan, it's not casting any shadows.
Right.
Because it's directly overhead, mm-hmm. Okay? So you won't get any shadows, and you can see it from the bottom of a very deep well. Now, he lived in Alexandria, and he knew that on the summer solstice in Alexandria, it did cast shadows. Okay? So you could see shadows. So that, in a stroke, proved that the Earth was round, because if the Earth was flat, it would look the same
from everywhere.
Or at least
spherical.
Or at least oblate spheroid, I think, is what we call it. And even better, from measuring... so there were a whole lot of pillars and all that sort of shit open in those days. So if he knew the height of the pillar that was casting the shadow in Alexandria, and if he knew the distance from Alexandria to Aswan, then using good old trigonometry... Who said that wasn't useful?
My gosh, I was just going to say, I could probably do that I learned that.
Indeed, you could probably do that. He figured out then the approximate circumference of the Earth. Okay, and that is remarkable. And he got it right to a bloody close degree. So the only uncertainty in his thing, he measured this distance in a thing called stades, and it's not quite sure exactly how long a stade was. They know sort of the limits of what it was. And so he came up with a circumference of between 40 and 45,000 kilometres, and it's around about 40 and a bit thousand kilometres. That's the generally accepted circumference of the Earth. So
that's awesome.
He did that, and it's so simple. And, you get subjected to trigonometry at school and stuff like that, and you probably think, shit, I'll never use this again. But this is over 2,000 years old, and we have sadly still got people who maintain that the Earth is flat.
I was going to say, you should maybe gather them all together and make them do that experiment.
Yeah. But doubtless they'll think up some way of sort of some alternative explanation.
Well, perhaps
of it
then they'll start doubting the math of it.
Oh, yeah. No, your trigonometry can't be correct.
No.
Obviously. But, brilliant. But
no judgment here, right? No judgment here. Just science.
So over 2,000 years ago. That's, it really is mind-blowing. And, that happened on this day, or on yesterday, over 2,000 years ago.
Perhaps they were just really smart back then.
Well, perhaps they, trigonometry is a pretty, awesome thing. And the sad thing was, he was one of these polymath things. So he was a bloody, what was he? He was an astronomer, a geographer, a mathematician, librarian, blah, blah, blah. And they had this enormous library at Alexandria that held all of these results and everything. And as you probably know, it burnt down, or it was an earthquake, or it burnt down. I can't remember which, but... A lot of the stuff was lost, so a lot of the knowledge was lost. So, when good old Christopher Columbus set sail for America, everyone was sort of thinking, shit, he's going to sail off the edge of the Earth. And this was in 1492 or whatever. They'd known that the Earth was round for 1,500 years before that.
Wow. No one thought to double check.
No one had the idea. Oh, okay.
Fascinating.
That was a good one.
Yeah,
Alan,
yeah,
good one. But I did want to spend a bit more time on this last one. We're talking about the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Yes.
Where
yes.
new information has come to light.
Well, really, really old information, really, but because it was, you know, it was recorded at the time, really, and how it's sort of not seen the light of day until today.
So why is it relevant now?
Well, so some of your listeners may have heard of a thing called the Milgram Experiment way back when, where this is a classic psychology experiment, if there is such a thing, where people were instructed to ask questions of people who were hidden, and every time they got an answer wrong, they would be instructed to give them an electric shock. And every time they got another answer wrong, they have to wind up the dial and, you know, more shock, more shock, more shock. And then these people would be screaming out in pain and everything, and there'd be a person in a white coat saying, no, keep going, keep going, keep going. And basically everybody kept going, regardless of the fact that these guys were obviously in pain. So this was an experiment all about sort of control and power and conformity and stuff like that, and, you know, authority. And so this was sort of in the mid-60s, I think, and then later on in the early 70s, 1971, there was the Stanford Prison Experiment, which is a similar sort of thing, designed to show a similar sort of thing. So they got 24 volunteers at Stanford in the Stanford Psychology Department, and what they did was to assign some of them as being prison guards and assign some of them as being prisoners. And so the prisoners were, you know, put in cells and they were divested of all of their belongings and they were referred to only by numbers, et cetera, just like in a real prison. And the guards had instructions to sort of maintain order by whatever means possible, really. And then they just put them in the basement of the Stanford Psychology Building and, you know, let them go for it. And this was meant to be a two-week experiment. And very, very soon after the experiment started, they sort of found that the guards and the prisoners were sort of getting into their roles a little bit too seriously, probably, and the prisoners were sort of conforming and the guards were sort of harassing the prisoners, etc., etc., etc. And then the prisoners started acting a bit crazy and they started, you know, yelling out and screaming out and blah, 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 as perhaps you might expect. And as a result of all of this, the experiment was stopped after 6 days of the planned 2 weeks because they were scared of people's sanities, basically. Wow.
Yeah. And what might happen?
Yeah, and what might happen, basically. You know, so seemingly the guards were really, really getting into it, so I think they were scared of sort of physical violence and et cetera, et cetera.
6 days.
And so this...
Yeah, you'd think it would take longer.
So this was used as, I guess, backup of the Milgram experiment, and they then said... Well, this then appeared in all of the sort of the first year psychology textbooks as being a classic example of the of conformity and et cetera, et cetera. But seemingly only very recently, some tapes of this experiment have emerged, some audio tapes, and some of the participants in the original experiment were then saying, oh no, I was just acting because this is what I thought the psychology people expected us to do. Mm. So, you know, they expected us to go crazy and stuff like that. And so this all appears to be backed up by audio recordings. And so seemingly now, from what I can see online, this is looking to be, you know, busted, as they would say in Mythbusters. So,
well, yeah, does it completely debunk the entire experiment?
It certainly looks like it does, yeah. And, I mean, not wanting to sound biased or anything, but that's my problem with psychology is you can't, and this sounds silly, you can't remove the human element from psychology experiments. And... in this case, it was the people wanting to please the experimenters and so acting in a way that they thought the experimenters wanted them to act.
Or already
that's probably a psychology experiment that's very own, you know, by itself. But how do you then remove that human element from all of these experiments? And, you know, especially when this is then accepted as gospel and it's taught to psychology first-year students
after.
For years and years and years and years. And, you know, that's a problem. And I don't know the way around that. I'm sure there'll be psychologists out there who will sort of defend it black and blue, but I'm just...
They will defend the Stanford...
Well, no, they'll defend the whole sort of psychology thing, and they will say that, you know, there are ways of taking the human bias and everything out of experiments. But and doubtless, you know, you'll use very complicated statistics and stuff like that. But as the great Ernest Rutherford once said, if your experiment relies on statistics, then you're doing the wrong experiment. You need a better experiment.
Because you're trying to find more truth?
Well, you know, statistics already is a little, you know, it's a little bit opaque for those of us who don't understand statistics, shall we say. And, you know, if you can, you can justify anything using statistics.
True. You can find some numbers to back up your claim.
That's just my pig ignorant view of the world.
Where are we at, though, in terms of, I mean, this is kind of a big deal. If they, if they're going to roll back the Stanford prison experiment, they're going to have to rejig psychology papers. Also, I mean, like, university papers, but also...
Well, they still have the Milgram experiment to go on. I mean, this...
Well, surely there'd be an investigation into that one now.
And there has been recent... I think I talked about it on this, like, last year or the year before or something, but they did do another Milgram experiment. I'm pretty sure that it sort of reproduced what they found originally. I'm pretty sure. Whereas this one, they did try and reproduce it recently, and they filmed it for the BBC and everything, and that didn't
work.
Isn't that also how you know whether your research is valid or not?
Is replication
absolutely as well.
Absolutely, it is. Yes. And so the fact that, and that's the trouble. Who the hell is going to take the time to replicate an experiment that is doubtless quite difficult to set up and prepare and everything like that? That's the trouble. In science, you don't get any credit for replicating things. You get credit for being first. And there's absolutely no credit for them coming along second and reproducing the results and saying, oh, yeah, it does work.
Even if it's more valid then for having that.
Well, even if it is more valid. The only time that you get credit for coming second is if you manage to debunk
who came first.
Yeah, that's when it's important. But people aren't going to waste their precious research time and their precious research dollars trying to replicate experiments. And that's why sort of... you get fraud in science, or you can get fraud in science, or you can get incorrect stuff in the literature.
Yeah, because aren't all experiments kind of, you know, they all have a different methodology, which can imply obviously different results, and so you'd have to double check for everything too.
Absolutely, and you'd have to do it exactly the same as they do it. Yeah. And again, here you've got the human element. You've got an entirely different human cohort, so who's to say that they're going to behave the same? You know, I just don't understand how they get around that. Mm. But I'm sure somebody will...
We'll hear about it in a few weeks, perhaps. But we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Alan.
Not a problem, Lillian. Always a pleasure.
See you next week.
Okay.
That was Dear Science.